Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Oral and Head and Neck Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 533 participants, so there's a lot of you on this call, over 533 participants, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large and small cities and rural and frontier communities, and we also have international participants from Belize, Canada, China, Jamaica, Korea, Syria, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you truly are an international group of participants on the call today. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about the topics our speakers will be covering, as well as our speakers, and all of the different collaborating organizations as resources for all of you to utilize after the call to use them ongoing as you need to. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to complete that form because your feedback is so very helpful to us. You know, when you think about it, you're in the best position to be able to tell us what you need us to offer, and your recommendations mean a lot to us in terms of topics that you'd like us to offer going forward. Indeed, today's program is one that has been, you know, consistently requested by many of you, and it really then helps us to get the support to do these programs. So I would ask you very much to tell us what you need us to do, and we'll try very hard to get the support to do them. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb and Imclone Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eli Lilly and Company, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have really quite a fantastic faculty speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. William Lydiot. Dr. Lydiot is professor, Department of Otolaryngology, Director of Head and Neck Surgery, University of Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Lydia is going to address staging and diagnosing, surgical interventions, including plastic and reconstructive surgery, and the importance of screening and early detection. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lydia.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure for me to be a participant in this call, especially with the people that you've lined up to speak. It's a very august group, and so I feel very privileged to be part of Cancer Care's organizational attempts at educating the public and people that are now currently either have had or may be concerned about having head and neck cancer. I want to start with the warning signs, the things that someone should take to their doctor and say, this is a concern I've had. And so one of the most important is hoarseness, a voice change or hoarseness that persists for longer than 2 to 3 weeks should have an evaluation. A sore throat, mouth sore, and more importantly even than the pain is the fact that it is present and doesn't get better. And I think it's really critical that you understand that, in fact, a lump or a sore in the mouth, an ulcer in the mouth that is not painful is actually more concerning than one that is. So that should be evaluated by either your dentist or your physician. Lumps anywhere in the body, but particularly those that occur around the ear, in the lower neck or the thyroid region, or in the neck on the sides by your major muscle called the sternocleidomastoid muscle. Those are all things that you should be aware of. If you feel a lump that you've not felt before, and again, whether it hurts or not, and typically cancerous nodes may not hurt. So it's very important that you have that evaluated by your doctor. Once one of these types of things is found, the doctor's going to evaluate, and you want to be able to tell them about things such as difficulty with swallowing. If you have anything that occurs on one side of your body, such as a nosebleed, hearing loss, or an earache, that is persistently on one side of the body and doesn't have an obvious source, such as an upper respiratory infection or other common infection. Numbness, anything that changes with respect to your eyesight or hearing, all of those things should be brought to the attention of your physician or your dentist. And once a diagnosis is made, once there is a suspicion, the next step will be in getting a biopsy. And the biopsy can be done either in the clinic or with what's called a fine needle, going into the mass and taking some of the cells out to have them looked at under the microscope. This will allow the physician to then do what's called staging. And typically this is going to be done by a head and neck surgeon. The way we stage cancers of the head and neck has to do with, first of all, how big it is, second of all, whether it's spread to lymph nodes, and third of all, whether it's spread outside of the head and neck area. And those are called T, N, and M for each of those respectively. So T is for the tumor, and it's either done by size for most places, such as the mouth, the oropharynx, the tonsil area, and or by extension into adjacent or next to structures. So, for example, in the voice box, if it sits on one place in the voice box, it's called a T1. If it's on two, it's a T2, etc. And this is something that the physician will do as part of their initial evaluation and workup, and it may require images such as CAT scans or other x-rays, MRIs, or a PET scan. The neck is going to be primarily by palpation, that is by feeling, and also done by imaging. And together, these will be put into what's called a stage. And the stage is either 1, 2, 3, or 4, and then there are 3 different categories within 4. But the most important thing to remember is that early stage, things that are do not have any spread into the lymph nodes are considered a stage 1 or 2. And if there is involvement of the lymph nodes, it's a stage 3 or 4. Unlike, though, many cancers, we're seeing a prognosis or the way people survive being spectacularly higher in stage 4 cancers. And what we found is that over the last 15 to 20 years, there has been a striking increase in the rate of human papillomavirus, or HPV-associated cancers. These are particularly in the tonsil and in the back of the tongue, and they oftentimes are not associated with tobacco use or alcohol use. They tend to present as a mass either in the mouth, in the tonsil area, or as a mass in the neck that is typically painless. And the prognosis can be so as good as 85 to 90% cure rates in these patients, even with stage 4 disease. So the last thing I want to say about staging is when you get your stage, be very mindful of the fact that staging is merely a way of us getting some sense of the scope of the disease, but it doesn't necessarily imply an ominous prognosis in the stage 4 like it may with other cancers. Next, we're going to briefly touch on some of the surgical interventions that may be employed. The primary goal of the surgeon is to get the cancer out and to leave the person with as limited of functional deficits as possible. So our goal is either to remove as little of tissue as possible or to restore that function by taking tissue from elsewhere in the body. We perform procedures called free flaps, which are a transplant of tissue from one portion of the body, such as the leg, the bone of the leg, for example, called the fibula, or tissue from the arm or the leg. And this is brought up to the head and neck, sewn into blood vessels in the head and neck area, and used to rehabilitate and to rebuild those structures that we've had to remove. For example, if we have to remove the jaw, the lower jaw, or in cases the upper jaw, we will reconstruct it with tissue from elsewhere. Now, we don't always need to reconstruct things. Sometimes we can do that just by the way we sew things together. Other times, maybe with skin grafts. And still other times, with a prosthetic rehabilitation. And oftentimes, that can give us the best results without having to bring tissue in. And I suspect Dr. Peterson might talk about that in his portion as well. The other, I think, growing and interesting intervention that we're now pursuing is robotic resections or endoscopic resections of cancers, such as cancers of the tonsil, cancers of the base of the tongue. And essentially what we use is we use the mouth as the natural orifice, so the natural way to get into the throat, and then using the robot we achieve very nice visualization. We can use lasers to then cut and make our incisions. And this can also be done endoscopically, depending on where the location of the tumor is. So oftentimes, this can be a very favorable way of approaching cancers in the tonsil area. The reason that's important is because we've learned that it's really all about trying to minimize removal or damage to normal structures as we're taking these cancers out. And so we continue to look at ways to either reconstruct or to avoid injury to various critical structures in the head and neck area to maximize the ability of patients to swallow and to speak afterwards. Finally, I'm going to talk just a little bit about screening and early diagnosis. There are several things that I mentioned in the when we were talking about warning signs and symptoms, and that was the painless lump. Well, another thing that you might find is a white patch, what we call leukoplakia, or a red patch, what we call erythroplakia. And these can be precancerous conditions, and so when those are present, this is clearly an indication to see your dentist or your doctor and have an evaluation to determine whether this is a concern for malignancy. Now, these can be treated a variety of ways, sometimes just getting rid of whatever the aggravating source is, for example, chewing tobacco, or it may be more complicated. It sometimes can be related to trauma, chronic trauma. Other times, it may be a thing called lichen planus. So there are a variety of different things that can cause abnormalities within the mouth and the throat. But when you have these, it's very important that they be assessed. And one more time, I want to stress the fact that these often will not be painful. And in fact, oftentimes they can look fair, like they should be painful and not be. And again, that's when it's very important to have an assessment done, which may include a biopsy, may include laser ablation, or perhaps a topical medication. And that's really, I think, the most important take-home message from my talk is that, number one, if you have something that has changed that isn't going away, whether it's painful or not, make sure and have that evaluated. Number two is that the goal of surgery is to try and improve function but still maintaining that high cure rate. And number three, consider the areas of your mouth and throat as another area that needs to be checked from time to time. And the ideal time is when you visit your dentist every 6 months. So it's been a pleasure to participate in the Cancer Care talk here, and I look forward to my colleagues' information as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lydiate, for just an exceptional presentation, very informative, and also for making the very complex more understandable for everybody. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Marshall Posner. Dr. Posner is Director, Head and Neck Medical Oncology, Professor of Medicine, the Tisch Cancer Institute, Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Dr. Posner is going to address the role of chemotherapy, new chemotherapy options, clinical trials, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Posner.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to the participants. I want to state at the beginning that I'm a medical oncologist, so my interests are primarily around the multidisciplinary treatment of head and neck cancer and the integration of chemotherapy into that multidisciplinary and multimodality treatment plan. This really requires that the patients who have head and neck cancer really see a group of physicians, an ENT oncologist, a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, even for the most minor of cancers, to really discuss the potential options and post-definitive therapy treatments. Chemotherapy works primarily to enhance the outcomes of surgery and radiation. It really is a part of a combined modality treatment and has to be given in the context of definitive therapy when we're treating patients for cure. Chemotherapy can be used as a treatment for palliation to improve quality of life and symptoms in patients who don't have an opportunity for cure. And in some settings, chemotherapy can be used as an adjuvant, that is, after definitive therapy, to enhance the curability of an individual. Chemotherapy today can be given with radiation, and there are a number of drugs that are quite effective. Cisplatin is the lead drug. Another drug that's used is Erbitux, an antibody to the EGFR receptor. These are given during radiation and are used to enhance the local control of the cancer with the radiation. They don't have any systemic activity against the cancers, but they will enhance local regional control and prevent recurrence of the cancer locally. These drugs are also usable in the postoperative setting when a patient's had surgery for a limited size tumor and there are poor prognostic features, that is, there are evidence that the tumor spread beyond the lymph nodes and into the soft tissues of the neck, or the surgeon has been unable to remove the entire tumor, leaving a positive margin, then chemotherapy is given with radiation, and I think it's reasonable to give either cisplatin or Erbitux as a treatment in that setting. Some people might give more aggressive therapies, including multiple drugs, and I do this often for patients where I'm concerned about high risk of recurrence, but that is really not a standard of care and should be done really in the context of expert therapy. I am a strong advocate of the role of using chemotherapy as an induction treatment prior to definitive radiation and surgery. That is called induction chemotherapy, and it's part of a sequential therapy treatment plan in which patients receive an aggressive course of chemotherapy prior to chemoradiotherapy. The advantages to that, of course, are that you have excellent reduction in tumor size. In fact, many of the tumors will almost completely disappear, and improvement if the tumor is causing problems with swallowing or breathing, an improvement right away in that process. And this translates into an improvement in functional outcome when the patient gets the combination of chemotherapy and radiation. One advantage of induction chemotherapy is it treats the whole body aggressively, and so spread of tumors outside of the head and neck region to the lungs or liver is prevented, and small tumor deposits in those areas are eliminated in large part by the systemic high-dose treatment. In addition, if the primary site is not completely resolved to scanning and physical examination, or there's evidence that the tumor is resistant to treatment, you can increase the amount of chemotherapy given during radiation and potentially improve local regional control for patients. And finally, surgery would be used in the context of residual disease, primarily in the neck or, for example, an oral cavity tumor for removal of an area where the tumor had been and where there would be a likelihood or possibility of recurrence. Chemotherapy, I've now covered chemotherapy as both a concurrent treatment with radiation, both as definitive therapy, as postoperative therapy, and I've talked about induction chemotherapy and chemoradiotherapy as sequential treatment for patients. And I think all of these offer very good opportunities for individuals to be cured, and I think they're all considered standard of care for treatment. Experimentally, there are a number of new studies ongoing. The Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, known as ECOG, is doing a study to evaluate the possibility of reducing radiation for patients with oropharynx cancer who have HPV-related oropharynx cancer. These tumors are caused by HPV, and they involve the base of the tongue and the tonsil. In that study, patients are being treated with induction chemotherapy, followed then by a course of chemoradiotherapy using Erbitux with a reduced dose of radiation. So instead of getting 7 weeks of radiation, they'll be getting 5.5. And this is hoped to give equal amounts of local control, but with less in the way of long-term consequences. There is also a study ongoing by the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group for a similar group of patients in which they are comparing cisplatin plus radiation to Erbitux plus radiation looking to see which of these might be least toxic and potentially most effective for this population. There are several other studies looking at adjuvant treatment that are ongoing or will be active soon, including a trial being run by one of the industrial groups, Boehringer Ingelheim, looking at an oral EGF receptor after chemoradiotherapy as an adjuvant. Patients will be randomized to different amounts of treatment or a placebo in an attempt to prevent recurrence of the disease after treatment. These represent different forms of therapy and different attempts to both reduce the toxicity of treatment and improve the outcomes for patients, as well as to explore new therapies for patients with these diseases. I want to emphasize that when a patient comes to see a physician with a head and neck cancer, that it's important to see all the members of the treatment team at one or another point and to get an opinion that's really a collaborative discussion by the radiation oncologist, medical oncologist, and surgical oncologist about what the treatment can be. For an individual patient, surgery alone may be sufficient or appropriate, or a combination of chemotherapy and radiation that includes one or another of many drugs, or even no drugs at all for an individual. So it's important to individualize the therapy. And now that we have a molecular marker for good prognosis, that's HPV virus involvement with a tumor, we can really begin to talk about giving more or less therapy to our patients. In addition, in the post-treatment setting, it's important to ask for help for swallowing and to see speech and swallowing therapists as well as social workers and pain management team members in order to manage the discomforts associated with treatment. I think today we have many tools to help treat patients and to get them through the therapy, and I think there's a lot of hope that we'll have some new agents soon to help manage those patients with poor prognosis disease. And I think this concludes my talk. I'd like to thank you again for having me on board, Carolyn. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Posner, for an excellent and informative presentation, also for identifying the fact that you are a medical oncologist. Dr. Lydia is an oncology surgeon, and also our next speaker, Dr. Rosenthal, is a radiation oncologist, and I will introduce each of you by your disciplines, because actually this is a multidisciplinary call. So what is so important is that you all have access to all of this team of experts for your care. So thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. David Rosenthal. Dr. Rosenthal is a radiation oncologist. He's professor, section chief, head and neck radiation oncology, Department of Radiation Oncology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Rosenthal will address the role of radiotherapy, concurrent radiation and chemotherapy, clinical trials, and pain and symptom management. I now turn this program over to Dr. Rosenthal.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here on this call today. I want to thank Cancer Care for inviting me to speak with you. I'm a radiation oncologist specializing in the treatment of head and neck cancer. Radiation therapy is a local therapy similar to surgery directed at the specific area of treatment in the throat or neck that is of concern. I want to talk to you today about the role of radiation therapy in treating patients with head and neck cancer. Additionally, how we can combine chemotherapy concurrent with radiation therapy, and how the sequence of these different combinations has developed in clinical trials to allow us to come to our current state of knowledge and give you some idea of where we're going. I additionally want to make a few comments on an important topic about pain and symptom management, because this is something that is sometimes overlooked but is very important, because we know that it's important not only for patients to be comfortable through their treatments, but we want to optimize their functional outcomes, especially when it comes to swallowing, which is one of the major areas that there can be problems. And we know that patients who have better symptom control have better outcomes. So I want to first say that our goal really is to work together with the different modalities of therapy, what we call a multidisciplinary team, involving the surgeons, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, so that we can work towards the era of personalized cancer therapy. And what we mean by this is to use new treatments that come along, where we might test a tumor and find a genetic abnormality that might be susceptible to a new drug directly. And some of these are being developed. For example, we have found that the human papillomavirus is an important prognostic factor in oropharynx cancer, tonsil and tongue base as an example. And we are looking for new treatments to target that specifically. Similarly, we have found that cetuximab, which is an antibody to the epidermoid growth factor receptor that is expressed on many head and neck squamous cancers, is also can be attacked by this antibody that, when given with radiation, has been shown in a clinical trial to improve local regional cancer control and survival, and have a different toxicity or side effect profile than when radiation and chemotherapy are given. So while on the one hand we're developing and working towards developing yet further new agents that are specifically directed towards a patient's tumor, it is also important that we tailor traditional cancer therapies that I mentioned, surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy, so that we have the right choice for the right patient. That is, the same shoe doesn't fit all feet. Just because a patient may have an oropharynx cancer, say a tonsil or tongue-based cancer of a certain stage, there's many differences amongst individual patients. So it's important that we work together to develop the right approach that is going to be the most effective for controlling the cancer with the fewest side effects and give the best functional outcomes with speaking, swallowing, and breathing. Now, one important thing to stress is the role of cancer clinical trials, and I encourage all of you to speak to your physicians about these opportunities and participating when appropriate. We have come to where we are in our current state of knowledge based on the participation of prior patients in these clinical trials, where we test different agents or combinations of therapies. With respect to the role of radiation therapy, what we have found is that radiation treatment has traditionally been given once a day, 5 days a week, for about 6 to 7 weeks. We found that giving radiation twice a day for part or all of the treatment could be beneficial to help improve local regional control for appropriately selected patients. One important clinical trial looked at the effect of testing twice daily radiation therapy in the setting of concurrent chemotherapy. So we learned that twice daily radiation can benefit some patients, and chemotherapy with radiation can benefit others. In RTOG trial 0129, all patients received concurrent chemotherapy with cisplatin. Half of the patients received once daily radiation, and the others were randomized to receive twice daily radiation. The results of this trial showed that in the setting of concurrent chemotherapy, twice daily radiation did not confer any additional benefit. And we know that it may be more toxic or add more side effects. So in general, outside of clinical trials, we are now proceeding with once daily radiation treatments when chemotherapy is given. Similarly, we have strived to develop these new treatments that have fewer side effects. This drug that I mentioned, cetuximab, the anti-EGF receptor antibody, was tested in a international phase 3 clinical trial where all patients received radiation treatment and half of them received this drug, cetuximab, concurrently. And this showed that there was about a 20% improvement in local control and survival for appropriately selected patients when that drug was given. This is what's called a biologic targeted agent and not a chemotherapy agent. The trial that we most recently completed in the RTOG, 0522, asked the question, well, we know that we're doing well with chemoradiation together for patients with more advanced tumors. What if we can add cetuximab to that? Would it make a difference? So half of the patients got chemoradiation alone and half got the addition of cetuximab. And this trial actually closed early because we found that there was no benefit to adding this drug to concurrent chemoradiation. Chemoradiation is valuable on its own. Cetuximab radiation is valuable on its own, but putting them together was also not found to be. So right now, we're moving ahead in new clinical trials looking at different combinations of radiation therapy and cetuximab, specifically in patients most commonly with oropharynx tumors, to try to determine what is the best combination with the fewest side effects. I want to also mention here that the main goal for treatment is to control the patient's cancer in the neck. If there's any risk of distant spread, we want to control that. And we want them patients to be at the lowest risk as possible for developing a separate cancer. We know that many cancers in the head and neck are caused by tobacco exposure, so we think that tobacco cessation is very important. So our goal when we use a multidisciplinary approach is to try to use these different combinations of chemotherapy and radiation and surgery to optimize control in all of these in these different areas. We've heard from Dr. Posner particularly about the role of induction chemotherapy, and it's very important that we select the appropriate treatments because chemotherapy can be most effective alone as induction for some patients and then for others concurrent with the radiation therapy so that we can address the major pattern of failure for which the patient is susceptible with the fewest toxicities. So in conclusion, I want to say that curative therapy is the goal for the vast majority of patients with head and neck cancer. In addition, organ preservation therapy is a reality for most patients. Many of these patients might be treated with radiation and chemotherapy approaches, but the head and neck surgeons have also made great strides in organ preservation therapy with new strategies. Additionally, we know that patients can suffer many symptoms from their cancers and from the cancer treatments. So it's important that patients are open and forthright with their healthcare team about symptoms that they have, whether this is pain, or discomfort or other symptoms, swallowing problems is something that we're always very concerned about, so that we can try to address these to achieve the maximal patient comfort so that we can get and achieve the best outcomes for individual patients. So it's important that we continue to support patients with proper oral and dental care that we're going to hear about, and with swallowing maneuvers and exercises, because our goal is to cure the patient and give the best outcomes with swallowing and natural speech as possible. I want to thank you for listening today. And again, I encourage everybody involved and new patients to speak to their doctors about cancer clinical trials so that we can try to improve cancer outcomes for current and future patients. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rosenthal, for just an excellent and compassionate presentation, very thoughtful, and just covered a lot of important areas here, and just in stressing the importance of really maintaining as much functionality for people as possible. And our next speaker is Dr. Jan Lewin. Dr. Lewin is a speech and swallowing expert, and she is a professor, Department of Head and Neck Surgery, Director, Section of Speech Pathology and Audiology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Lewin is really going to address the ways that can, how important it is to preserve speech and swallowing. And I'm going to turn the program now over to Dr. Lewin.
Thank you, Carolyn. I have participated in many of the cancer care conferences, and I really want you to know that I have enjoyed each and every one because they're always so informative and well organized. The survival rate for patients with oral cancer has been steadily increasing since 1975. More people resume their everyday life both during and after treatment. Advances in treatment are changing the way we view cancer. Once considered a terminal illness, cancer is increasingly viewed more like a chronic disease, such as heart disease or diabetes, that can be managed with therapy, lifestyle changes, and monitoring. Long-term speech and swallowing function is important to quality of life and therefore has become paramount to the selection of treatment for patients with oral and head and neck cancer. So the question I will try to address today is, have we made progress in preventing functional deterioration from the standpoints of both the cancer treatment itself as well as our preventative speech and swallowing therapies? Data from the past 10 to 15 years has clearly shown that surgery or radiation therapy, with or without the addition of chemotherapy, will result in specific and sometimes different kinds of swallowing problems depending on the site of the tumor. In general, patients who are treated surgically experience functional disabilities that are usually proportional to the volume of the resection. Thus, functional problems are mostly a result of the postoperative change in or loss of anatomical structure. When reconstruction is needed, research has found that flaps that fill the surgical defect produce better ability to swallow and speak than bulky ones that overfill the space. New data shows that laser surgeries, especially laser resections of small tumors, may have better functional outcomes than traditional surgeries as well as radiation therapy. After laser surgery, patients generally have shorter hospital stays and experience faster medical recovery. In select cases, radiation therapy may actually be avoided. Patients frequently regain swallowing ability faster without the severe side effects caused by radiation therapy. However, laser surgery cannot be done for all patients, and in some cases, it may be contraindicated. Highly experienced surgeons and speech pathologists should be able to provide evidence-based information to help patients select the right alternative to treat their cancer while at the same time to preserve their ability to speak and swallow. Alternatively, the effects of radiation therapy will produce immediate as well as long-term changes in speech, voice, and swallowing that may increase in severity years after the completion of the radiation. In general, radiation has a greater effect on swallowing than it does on speech. Patients who have swallowing problems before treatment are at higher risk for chronic swallowing disability after treatment, and they are also at higher risk for permanent feeding tube dependence. The addition of chemotherapy can make the problems worse because chemotherapy accentuates the effects of the radiation. Early swallowing recovery from radiation therapy may be misleading because of the delayed scarring that we call fibrosis, and the occurrence of neuropathies that cause long-term swallowing deterioration. Late swallowing dysfunction and aspiration have been reported in up to 60% of patients treated with radiation therapy. Between 15 and 30% of patients who aspirate will require a feeding tube for nutrition. But experience shows that by delaying the placement of a feeding tube until it's clinically indicated may in fact help preserve long-term swallowing function. Our data has shown that regardless of the presence of a feeding tube, it is essential to continue to swallow whatever you can, even if it is just your own saliva. Patients who receive radiation therapy must continue to swallow throughout the course of radiation therapy to help ensure long-term swallowing ability. Data from MD Anderson shows that when the larynx is not involved with cancer, the use of a traditional larynx block in combination with IMRT can spare critical parts of the larynx from excessive radiation exposure and ultimately decrease the risk of chronic swallowing problems. Therefore, good questions to ask your radiation oncologist are, will I be receiving IMRT, and do you use a traditional larynx block with the IMRT? Recently, targeted molecular therapies or biologic treatments in combination with radiation are being used to pinpoint specific genetic alterations in the tumor itself and spare normal tissue cells from damage. Again, early data suggests that acute mucosal toxicity and swallowing outcomes are not worsened by the addition of targeted molecular drugs to radiation. Now let's turn our attention to the progress we have made in our preventative and rehabilitative therapies. As we discussed previously, we clearly know what to expect after surgery and radiation therapy in terms of functional change. Unfortunately, current data doesn't tell us which patient will experience the most severe speech and swallowing problems long term. Speech and swallowing depend on a very precise and well-coordinated interaction of muscle groups in the oral cavity and throat. New research has defined specific swallowing exercises that target the muscles that will likely be impaired after head and neck cancer treatment. Emerging data support the use of these preventative swallowing exercises that start early before the cancer treatment begins. There are no pills, no medications, and in most cases, no surgeries that will fix swallowing problems once they have occurred. Findings show that patients who perform swallowing exercises before, during, and after treatment have a better swallowing-related quality of life, maintain adequate muscle tone and physiology, and, most importantly, are less dependent on feeding tubes both during and after treatment. Patients should ask for swallowing exercises before radiation therapy begins and continue to do them throughout their treatment as much as possible. Another comment I would like to make relates to a relatively new therapy that is being used by many speech pathologists to improve swallowing in patients treated for oral and head and neck cancer. This therapy uses electrical or surface stimulation placed against the neck to induce muscle movement to improve swallowing function. Despite its therapeutic popularity, data from the National Institutes of Health suggests that electrical or surface stimulation may in fact be harmful to swallowing and airway protection in some patients. In other words, the use of electrical or surface stimulation actually makes swallowing function worse in select patients. Therefore, it is very important that the appropriateness of electrical or surface stimulation as a treatment for swallowing impairment be properly evaluated and its efficacy confirmed before it's used. In conclusion, clinical and research experience show that in many cases, long-term speech and swallowing dysfunction can be avoided. It is critical that patients seek information and treatment from experts who are very familiar with head and neck cancer, its diagnosis, treatment, and its functional sequelae. Despite the availability of data and the expectation that clinicians should be knowledgeable, many patients with oral and head and neck cancer are still not referred for speech and swallowing evaluation. Therefore, they never receive accurate information regarding long-term speech and swallowing function, nor do they receive the therapy to prevent long-term problems. It is absolutely critical that if you have not been referred, to ask for an appointment with an experienced speech pathologist before your cancer treatment begins. We at MD Anderson Cancer Center are partnering with colleagues from around the country and the world to develop a predictive model for the prevention of speech and swallowing dysfunction. Our goal must ultimately be to identify those patients who are at risk to avoid long-term functional deterioration after treatment for head and neck cancer. And with that, I'll conclude, and I want to again thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me to participate in this fabulous conference. Thanks again.
Well, I thank you, Jan, Dr. Lewin, so much for participating on this program today and for really bringing to light for everyone on the call today the importance of a speech and swallowing expert on your team. We have a whole team of experts here. And just hearing about the efforts at MD Anderson to really reach out across the country to really make this available to all centers is so important. So be aware of this expertise and do take advantage of it. It's really important. Our next speaker is Dr. Doug Peterson. Dr. Peterson is a doctor of dental medicine. He's professor of oral medicine, chair program in head and neck cancer and oral oncology, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. Dr. Peterson is a frequent presenter on many of our programs, actually, and he is really going to focus on the guidelines for dental care during and after treatment and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Peterson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I, too, am delighted to be part of this very important discussion today. And I'd like to introduce a few overall concepts and then provide some specific information for our audience. First, I'd like to highlight that there are some very important and highly successful dental approaches that can be utilized before, during, and after completion of the treatment of the oral or the head and neck cancer. And the goal of these dental approaches is to ideally prevent or at least minimize any problems with the patient's mouth during the cancer treatment and in the years after the cancer treatment. So the goal really is to prevent or at least minimize mouth problems associated with the cancer treatment. And I'll be summarizing some of these specific approaches and ideas in my presentation today. I'd like to also emphasize that there are excellent resources, such as our discussion today and many other resources through cancer care, for cancer patients and their families, and as well for the cancer team. And together, in partnership, we can work together to make the best decisions about treatment and cooperation, and that includes how best to manage the mouth, the oral cavity, as part of this overall head and neck cancer experience. I'd also like to really reemphasize some of the points that have been made by several of my colleagues on this call so far, and that is the absolute value of communication of the patient and the family with the healthcare team. This is so important. It helps the cancer team provide the very best care possible for the patient, and it can also be extremely valuable in reducing any concerns that the patient and the family may have. And so by working together with the patient and the family and the healthcare team, it can go a long way to preventing or at least minimizing complications that occur in the mouth because of the cancer treatment. So with that background, I'd like to talk in the next few minutes about some of the specific approaches we take from the dental care perspective for the head and neck cancer patient. I'd like to start with what's relatively new relative to guidelines for dental care in these patients. As we've heard from Dr. Lydiat earlier today and most recently from Dr. Lewin, there have been exciting recent advances in head and neck cancer treatment. These advances include new technologies to focus the targeting of the radiation on the cancer, as well as development and use of drugs that are specifically focused to attack the cancer cells and not the normal cells themselves. So these advances often permit the oncology team to protect more of the normal tissue than was ever previously possible. And this includes protecting the normal tissues of the mouth. And this new model very much influences the way the dental team provides dental care to the head and neck cancer patient. Dr. Lydiat also mentioned the very impressive approaches that can be taken with restoring the form and function of the oral cavity and of the oral pharynx through surgery and through working with the dental team. And there are dental specialists, for example, maxillofacial prosthodontists, who are highly experienced in working with the rest of the cancer team in designing and helping reconstruct the oral cavity after the surgery in order to provide optimal form and function. So again, all of these advances in recent years really speak to the opportunities and goals that the cancer team can provide working with the patient and the patient's family and caregivers. Now, there are some other aspects that aren't quite as new as the targeted radiation therapy or the new molecularly focused drugs against cancer or some of the new materials, biomaterials advances in dental medicine that we use to help restore the form and function of the oral cavity. But although some of these other areas aren't quite as new, they continue to be very, very important. So I'd like to just spend a couple of minutes addressing these aspects as well. And I'm going to start with some simple definitions. Often when we think about dentistry and the dental role, it would be easy to think about only the teeth, the dentition. And certainly the teeth can be a very important tissue and organ that we need to protect in the head and neck cancer patient. But we also need to be thinking about the mouth, or what we call the oral cavity in general. And this includes the teeth. It also includes the gum. It includes the mucosa of the mouth, or the lining tissues of the mouth, as well as the salivary glands. And the reason I mention these areas is that because head and neck radiation, with or without chemotherapy, can cause temporary or sometimes permanent changes in the mouth tissues. And given the complexity of some of these mouth complications, it's important to have comprehensive management by the dental team in order to ideally prevent these problems. Now, some of the problems are temporary, such as mouth sores, and I'm going to comment on that. Other complications, such as dry mouth or what we call another condition, osteoradionecrosis, can really be lifelong. And some of these problems can lead to pain or complications in the bone. Now, the good news is that mouth sores can be managed as far as their pain and watching for any infection. And the dry mouth or the osteoradionecrosis can be ideally prevented or at least minimized by having the dental team work with the rest of the cancer team in advance of the cancer treatment and then in the years that follow that cancer treatment. Now, we heard some very important information regarding pain control from Dr. Rosenthal, and I'd like to emphasize that just keeping the mouth clean and moist during the head and neck radiation treatment is very, very important. It doesn't prevent the mouth sores per se, but if the mouth sores develop and become painful, there are pain medications that can be given by pill or injection. Now, none of these approaches for mouth sores, again, specifically prevent the problem, but they can go a long way in reducing the discomfort. And as far as the dry mouth that may occur because of the effect of head neck radiation on salivary glands, this can be a problem in some patients. And some of the problems can result in taste or chewing, swallowing, and speaking difficulties. We've heard quite a bit about that today. Now, the treatments for the dry mouth are varied, again, to be discussed with the cancer team, including the dental team, but just keeping the mouth moist, sipping water or sugarless drinks, avoiding drinks with caffeine, avoiding tobacco or alcohol, since these products can dry out the mouth, avoiding spicy or salty foods, since these may irritate the mouth. These are some of the simple strategies that can be considered if the patient has dry mouth caused by the radiation. Now, we're going to hear some additional very important information in just a few minutes regarding nutrition from our next speaker, Ms. Denise Anderson, so I'll defer to her relative to the nutritional aspects. So in summary, I'd like to emphasize that there are some excellent approaches that the dental team can include, can incorporate into your cancer treatment, again, working in close collaboration with the rest of the healthcare team. It's very important to communicate, to discuss any questions or concerns you have with your cancer team well before starting the cancer treatment, and discuss that the best approach with the dental team as well. And then together this team can help you during and after the actual cancer treatment itself. And this kind of cooperation, this kind of communication, this kind of partnership can lead to very positive outcomes, both during the cancer treatment as well as for many years thereafter. I'm going to stop at this point and turn the presentations back to Carolyn. Thank you very much, Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Peterson, for an extraordinary, superb presentation and really for covering this very important area in terms of care of mouth and teeth and just all the tips that you've given everybody. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Denise Anderson. Denise is Senior Clinical Dietitian, Department of Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Denise is a dietitian, and she is going to review with you nutritional concerns and tips. Denise?
Thank you, Carolyn. I look forward to this every year. I wanted to start out by saying that most treatments for head and neck cancer, have it be from surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, can affect your eating. These treatments will increase your need for nutrition and may require diet texture modifications, and you may need nutrition support in the form of a feeding tube to meet your goals. Eating well during your treatments can lower your fatigue level by giving you enough energy and keeping your strength up as well as maintaining your weight. Patients that maintain their nutritional status tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery after their treatments have completed. To help you meet your nutritional needs and goals, ask your doctor if you can see a dietitian. At that consult, you can be provided with your calorie needs, your protein needs, and your fluid needs. They can also provide you with other information that can help you eat when dealing with the side effects of all of these treatments. One of the most common side effects to these treatments is weight loss. This is mainly related to the decrease in food intake due to difficulty in chewing, swallowing, and just in general oral cavity pain. Excessive weight loss can lead to treatment delays or breaks in treatments. The main nutritional goal during your treatment is to maintain your weight and your lean muscle mass. This goal can be achieved by meeting the calories, protein, and fluid needs that are provided by your dietitian. Remember that during cancer treatment, these needs may increase. When looking at your diet, calories will provide you with the energy that you need to maintain your weight and promote healing after treatment. Calories come in the form of carbohydrates, fats, and protein. To help you meet your calorie needs, you may need to have small, frequent meals, as many as you need to meet your goals. Foods can also be fortified to add more calories in the small amounts that you may be eating during this time. Protein in your diet helps protect your lean muscle mass and aids in healing. The protein that you eat, your body can use for energy and healing, sparing your lean muscle mass. It is best to include a protein source at each meal. Sources of protein can include eggs, dried beans, dairy products, and meats. Protein supplements can also be purchased to help with protein intake. However, have your medical team review the product prior to use and to make sure that it's an appropriate supplement to use during your treatment. Adequate intake of fluids will also keep you hydrated. Dehydration can make your side effects feel worse. It can increase nausea, increase dry mouth, thick saliva, fatigue, and make you feel tired and dizzy. Fluids are anything that's a liquid, water, juices, sports drinks, soups, milkshakes, smoothies, and even ice cream. So make sure that you stay adequately hydrated as you go through these treatments. Keeping a daily food record of your intake can be very helpful. It will make you aware of how often and how much you are eating. There are several calorie counters that you can access on the Internet. Your dietitian may be able to refer you to some of them. Reading food labels are also helpful. Food labels will help provide the calories and proteins in the amounts of foods that you are eating to help you keep track of that. During treatments, diet modifications may be necessary due to the difficulty in swallowing and pain when eating. Patients may already be modifying their diets prior to treatments. An example of that modification is if you are eating a regular diet, this can change to a soft diet, then decrease to a chopped diet, further decrease to a pureed, and even a liquid diet. You may have to supplement your diet during these changes with smoothies and shakes, and a protein powder may be helpful to ensure adequate protein intake. There are also liquid supplements over-the-counter that can be used as well. Check with your provider on what they recommend for you to use. Many recipes can also be located on the Internet for smoothies and milkshakes and pureed foods. Keywords to search for are things like liquid diet, dinner through a straw, blenderized diets. This really does help patients when these diets change to help them find recipes and way to adapt to their new changes. If you continue to lose weight and not meet your nutritional needs, a feeding tube may be necessary. Feeding tubes can be placed at any time during treatments. Patients who are underweight or who have lost a large amount of weight prior to treatment may want to consider having a feeding tube placed prior to starting. For others, if you start having weight loss and you cannot control this weight loss or can continue to decrease your intake of food, then consider the placement of a feeding tube. Feeding tubes should not be considered long-term. The length of time that you may have a feeding tube is different for everyone, and it depends on how nutritionally depleted you become. Feeding tubes can be used to help you achieve your nutritional goals and to help you with healing after you've completed treatment. Once placed, the feeding tube can become your primary source of nutrition and hydration, but not your only source. You can continue to eat my mouth even with a feeding tube unless you have been told by your doctor not to. Continuing to eat will help preserve your swallow function, which can change and become weak, especially during radiation treatment. After cancer treatments, nutrition continues to be important. You will want to continue to meet your nutritional needs to ensure adequate healing. If you have a feeding tube in place, you will need to work with your dietitian to help you decrease the use of your feeding tube and resume a normal diet. Long-term side effects that may occur that may affect your food intake after treatment is taste changes or no taste and dry mouth. Continue to try different foods to help identify the foods that you may not be able to taste or that you like. This may get better over time with healing. Remember that foods that you don't like prior to the treatments, you may like them now, so try them. To help with the dry mouth, you may want to eat foods that are moist and avoid foods that are spicy and have a lot of bread and breading. Using gravies and sauces can help with the eating during this time, but they may not be healthy over a long period of time. Try to match your flavors with things like chicken broth or beef broth. That will help add the moisture to the food and not so many calories that are high fat. When starting to eat again, your diet may not be as varied as it was prior to your treatment, so taking a daily multivitamin may help complete your diet. You only need a vitamin that meets 100% of your daily needs. Remember that the American diet is highly fortified, and you may be eating foods that already have these added vitamins. As a final point, you need to remember that your main goal is to maintain your weight and your lean muscle mass. You may be able to eat your way back into weight gain, but you can't eat your way back into muscle gain. You will have to rebuild your muscles. Your eating may not be the same as before, but as long as you're getting the foods that you need for a healthy diet, you will be fine. Thank you again, Carolyn. I'm going to turn it back over to you for letting me be a part of this network.
Thank you so much, Denise, for just an excellent presentation and very comprehensive. And I want to say that this has been an extraordinary program. I want to thank all of our speakers. I want to thank all of you who've been listening. This is a one-hour program, and that I want to remind all of you that you can access services from Cancer Care. We have a staff of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers. I'm an oncology social worker, and we provide a host of services from practical and financial assistance to counseling to support groups to programs like this, workshops, as well as materials and booklets that we have available for you. Most importantly, I would not want anyone to feel that you are alone when this program ends. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and Cancer Care is here for you. You can call us anytime at 1-800-813-4673, and our staff are happy to be of help to you to really help you with your concerns. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. That concludes the workshop. You may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.